Reading from Mark chapter 3, starting in verse 7. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard about all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. For he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried, "You are the Son of God!" But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. Please be seated.
Thank you. Morning, church. It is good to be with you guys this morning. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Peyton, and I am the youth pastor here at Central Heights. And man, is it a pleasure to be with you guys today. Fathers, shout out you guys. Happy Father's Day. I would not be here today without you, so thank you. Much appreciated. Oh man, this is good. Okay, I'm going to open up with a question. Have you ever been bear sprayed before? I hope not. I have. It sucked. I just want to tell you guys a quick story. It was just over a year ago. It was actually the same week that I had started my job here at Central Heights. And I just moved out and met this guy. His name was Zach. Now, Zach is now one of my best friends. But Zach moved to Chilliwack all the way from the East Coast. And he hadn't ever hiked before on the West Coast, and I was like, this is going to be our introduction to our friendship is a beautiful hike. So instead of doing something super simple, we decided that we are going to go camp at the base of a mountain in my car, sleep for 2 hours because it took us a long time to get there, wake up at 3 a.m. and hike to the top of this mountain so that we could watch the sunrise. This guy's not hiked anything like that before. We woke up in the darkness. We knew we were in bear country, and so of course we had bear spray. And we start hiking and hiking. And then all of a sudden that hike actually turned to rock climbing. Yeah. And all we had were these little headlamps. And we're climbing along this ridge now. And he's genuinely in silent because of how terrified he is. Now I grew up a rock climber, so I'm like, this is great. He's like, shivering in his timbers, as they say. And as we're climbing, I'd put my bear spray on my back at this point, and it knocks on a rock, and all I hear is, whoosh, and it goes down my pants. And all of a sudden, I just hear behind me, my eyes! And I'm just like, this is the worst. It's pitch black. We can see the sun peeking, hundreds of feet on either side of us, bear spray on my back, and bear spray in his eyes. It was horrible. Horrible. Now, luckily for me, the bear spray didn't activate right away. So for the first thing that comes to my mind is, he's never going to want to hike with me again. Genuinely. I was like, are you kidding me? This is how our friendship starts? And then I was like, his wife's never going to let him hike with me again. It was so scary. Now, because we're tough, we finished that hike. Absolutely finished that hike. And when I say this, I actually mean this. I was genuinely praying that this would not hurt the start of what I was hoping to be a great friendship, and that we'd be able to do more adventures like this. Now, what was, and honestly, this too, I was praying that even though he had bear spray in his eyes, that he would still be able to see the beautiful things that were in front of him, that would not ruin or alter or change his view of the goodness at hand. I'm gonna pray, and then I'm gonna reread this passage, and we're gonna dive in. So let's bow our heads. Father, I thank you for this day. God, I thank you that you're good. I thank you that you are always present, and I pray we would be more aware of that presence. Jesus, I just pray that you'd speak to us through your word and through your Holy Spirit, that you'd convict us, that we would be comforted in that conviction, knowing that you care about us, that you want us to grow and change. And God, may you just give us peace today. Help us walk away from this morning knowing something more about you and growing in relationship with you. Calm my mind and my heart and help me to speak clearly. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, I'm going to read this passage one more time. Mark chapter 3, verse 7 through 12. If you're not there in your Bibles yet, please open to that with me. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard about what he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him, for he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. The first time you read the passage, or first time you've heard this passage, what may have stood out to you and what certainly has stood out to me was the end of that. Verse 11 and 12. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." They're recognizing him as the Messiah. But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. This seems almost problematic. Whenever the impure spirits saw him and called him out for who he was, Jesus stopped them. In my original notes, I have this verse highlighted in red. Because why would Jesus not want people to know who he is? It was highlighted in red because I did not want to talk about it. That's weird a little bit, in my opinion. Maybe I shouldn't say that about the Bible. Either way, it's what stood out. And I highlight that now just because I want you to know that I see that, but we're going to circle back to that. In fact, I actually see a couple of things that lead up to it that I think will give a little bit of context for that verse. With some very clear and specific language, starting in verse 7, it says this: Jesus withdrew with his disciples. Then again, verse 9, it says, because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. And then we have verse 12. He is recognized as the Son of God and says, "Don't tell others about me," hiding the fact that he is the Messiah. In this passage, what we see is Jesus actively pushing away from the people that he loves. He's actively withdrawing. He's actively creating space. He's actively withholding who he is. Why? I don't know about y'all, but this causes a little bit of tension in me. These were people who were here to see him. They did love him. These were the sick and the poor and the needy. They were reaching out to touch him. If only they could just touch him, they would be healed. How could Jesus hide who he was and his character and create space from those people? And this is actually something that we see as a common pattern for Jesus in the New Testament. We've already seen it a couple times in the book of Mark leading up to this moment where it's this pattern. Jesus starts healing, the crowds come, and then Jesus withdraws. Multiple times we see that. We also see multiple times in this book of Mark that Jesus heals somebody or is recognized as Messiah and then says, "Do not tell anyone about me." It's a pattern. But why? Why withdraw? Why a boat? Why silencing the recognition? Okay, let's go back into the passage. Verse 8, referring to the crowds. When they heard what he was doing, they came. The people were there for healing, which is fair. But they were there not for who he was, but what he gave them. Let's build on that. Verse 10, it says this: the people are pushing just simply to touch him. Again, they are sick and they are hurting. Of course, if they knew that they could just touch the robes of this man, that they would be healed, they would do it. I would do it. No brainer. I would do it even if it would make my hair grow back. That would be a miracle. It makes sense. Jesus is healing so many people that they're coming from all around. They've heard about it and they just want to touch him. Of course, they want healing. Years of pain just gone at the touch of a robe. And not only that, we know that Jesus wants to heal them. It's a part of his mission. He's stated it. In the book of Luke, in the beginning, he talks about it, how he's come to bring freedom to the captives, to bring life to the poor, to revive the sight of the blind. Like, it's a part of his mission. It's even prophesied in the Old Testament that a part of confirming who the Messiah is, he would be a healer. And he wants to do it. We saw it in passages just before this. His desire is to heal. He wasn't angry about people coming to ask for healing. That's not him. That's not his character there. But he wants to heal more than just the physical. There's more to it. Let me explain this in a little bit of a different way. C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I promised myself that I would never quote C.S. Lewis. Like, I just didn't want to, because every pastor and their mom is quoting C.S. Lewis in a sermon. Right? But he's that good. Just so we're clear, he's that good. And I just read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe again, and I did cry. I acknowledge. But if you have not read it, read it. But if you have not read it, Narnia is this magical land. It really mirrors a lot of what we see in the gospel. C.S. Lewis is a brilliant thinker. And this land that this group of young kids enters into has been held captive by the White Witch. And she's actually put a curse on the land that's made it be sent into winter for 100 years, just constantly. They describe it as winter with no Christmas ever for 100 years. And the White Witch is there holding them as slaves as well. And then in the book, there's this moment where the snow begins to melt. Not a lot has quite happened yet, but the snow begins to melt. And the people begin to realize that something is going on. There's this figure in the book, his name's Aslan. He represents, in the book, God and also Jesus, they're the same. And the melting of the snow made all the people begin to realize that Aslan must be present. You see, Aslan in the book came to end winter, but that wasn't actually his main goal. His main goal was to defeat the White Witch, and in doing so, ended the 100-year winter. The melting of the snow was not the main point, but the melting of the snow showed that the king was present. It's the same with miracles. Jesus' miracles were not the main point, but they showed that the king was present. Now, these people, they were there for the healing, these crowds. Not to be with the king, though. Great. But still, why does Jesus withdraw? Why not reveal who he is? Let's talk about verse 11 and 12 now. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. For this, we're going to need to go into a little bit of the context behind the scenes. You see, Jesus here is actually aware of something that the crowd is not. He's aware of the mission. He's aware of the main point. He knows the cross is coming. And his 3 years of ministry leading up to that moment on the cross are crucial. In fact, we know that Jesus is not actually fully revealed as the Messiah until he suffers, dies, and raises again. We actually see that really clearly in the book of Mark, because at the end of the book of Mark, there's only two people who recognize him, and it's when he dies. Leading up to that, nobody really sees that he's the Messiah. Peter, one of the followers, gets really close in chapter 8. Jesus asks him, "Who do you think I am?" Peter says, "You are the Messiah." Then Jesus explains to him what's going to happen. "I'm going to die." And then Peter rebukes him. And then Jesus rebukes Peter back and says, "Get behind me, Satan." So Peter was close. But nobody actually was able to clearly recognize Jesus as the Messiah until he died and was crucified as a suffering servant. It was the burglar on the cross beside him and the centurion who watched him die who said, "Surely this must be the Son of God." That was crucial. And these people don't get that. They can't get that. You see, these people have been awaiting a Messiah for a really long time. It's been prophesied in the Old Testament. We see it all throughout. But to them, that Messiah did not look like Jesus. To them, the Messiah was supposed to be a king from the line of David. Jesus was that. Who would free them from their oppressors. Jesus did that. Who would rule with justice and live out the Mosaic law perfectly. Again, Jesus did those things. But they wanted it to be in their own way. We talked about Jesus being Lord over the Sabbath the other day. It's true. Jesus was talking about this law that was passed to them, and he was talking about how it was actually meant to be, but it didn't fit in their vision of how that law was supposed to be fulfilled. They just couldn't see it. They had a view of Jesus or of the Messiah that Jesus was not fitting for them. But if the people found out he was the Messiah, they would certainly rush him into a position of power as their leader against the Romans who were oppressing them. Again, they were looking for a Messiah who would free them from their captors. And certainly, the Romans would stamp that out fast. Nobody lived if they tried to rebel against the Romans. You see, the people wanted their Messiah to be a worldly king when Jesus was the king of the world. They wanted to be free from their captors without knowing what was actually holding them prisoner was sin and death. The crowds did not want Jesus for who he was. Just to really make it clear, these crowds who came to be healed are the same people who yelled, "Crucify him." They saw and experienced Jesus and still said, "Crucify him." So why the withdrawing? Why the boat? Why silencing the demons who recognized him? Because Jesus wanted to be with his disciples. And the view that the crowds have of him and the view that the demons have of him are stopping them from being able to withdraw with him and truly know him. You see, the crowds did not see Jesus as the Messiah because he didn't fit into their view of Messiah. The demons recognized him as Messiah, but intentionally live against him. Are your views of Jesus stopping you from being able to withdraw with him? Stopping you from seeing who he really is? Last year, I went on a trip to Germany. Took a little bit of time off. It was awesome. I was out visiting one of my best friends. I took a week-long class on the book of Exodus. It was the best. And then I was boarding a flight to get home from Paris to Calgary. It was about 9 hours. And as I was boarding the plane, I felt like a conviction, like a sense in me that I needed to try to go this entire flight without any technology. Oy. And if you're looking at me, you can probably see based on my age that I probably struggle with some sort of crippling addiction to technology. It sucked. Luckily, I'm extremely extroverted, which means for everyone else around me, that sucks. We're gonna be best friends. Even better, I'm middle seat. I gotta talk to everyone. It's gonna be fantastic. So I walk on this plane already with this stirring in my stomach of like, seriously, am I really gonna go this entire flight with no tech? I mean, I just came off this beautiful week of rest. Like, let me just chill out. It's gonna be 9 hours of this. Are you kidding me? And so I sit down, and pretty much immediately, a conversation starts with the man on my left. We don't know each other's names. We don't know what each other do. But what I do find out is that he is in Paris because he loves art. In fact, he's an art collector himself. Loves it. Now, me being the extrovert I am, held a conversation about art for 2 hours. That's a miracle. Miracle. I know nothing about art. He's pulling up photos of his collection going, "How does it make you feel?" I'm like, "Good." Like, I don't know. That's great. Artists, love you guys. You do beautiful work. It's just not there yet. We just talked about that for 2 hours. And then finally, he saw that I had a couple books in the pocket in front of me, and he asked me about one of them, and I was able to explain to him, well, actually, I'm a pastor, and we start talking about what we do, and I find out he's like a pretty well-known retired politician. And then all of a sudden, we start talking about what it looks like to be a pastor and his experience with the church and how he actually grew up with a great experience with the church and loved a lot of what Jesus had to say. He also told me he's friends with the Dalai Lama. That's crazy. I don't even know who that guy is, but he seems important, I think. But he made it really clear that he was friends with, yeah, anyway. Again, but he just kept talking about how he had these really positive things, but he had one thing that he said to me that really stood out, and it was this. There's no way Jesus was so prideful that he would claim he's the only way. He had a view of Jesus that was withholding him from being able to retreat with him, that was withholding him from being able to see who he truly was, that was creating separation. I haven't even talked about the guy on my right yet. You guys ready for this? He leans over, the politician leans over me, taps him on the shoulder, and the guy looks over. He's like, what's your name? Where are you from? It turns out he's a Jewish man from Israel who's studying Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. And then he goes, well, this is interesting. This guy's a pastor. And I'm like, all right, what's going on? He had no idea that I just came from a week-long class of one of the first five books of the Old Testament, which led to such a beautiful conversation. I wish I could unpack that with you guys, but that's not the point of today. I'm sure it'll come up later. He asked me one question, though, that really stood out to me, and it was this. Why do you feel like you need the New Testament if you already have the Old? We got to quickly explain how Jesus actually fulfills all of the things in the Old Testament and actually how beautiful the representation of the tabernacle, which is explained in Exodus, is reflected in who Jesus is. But he views Jesus as a false prophet who simply died. His view of who Jesus is stopped him from being able to withdraw with Jesus and truly know who he is. Both of these people, who I would call my friends now, I actually have that politician's phone number. And he's asked me to go wine tasting and look at art, which, again, for neither of those things are my day. It would be a nightmare. I'm not going to. With love. But both these people, on my left and my right, had bear spray in their eyes. They had something obstructing their view that was withholding them from seeing what was actually happening, from seeing the true beauty, the true good of who Jesus is. It's the same with all of us, I think, in many ways. And what does Jesus want? Verse 7 says he just wants to withdraw with his disciples. Here's the thing. We all got stuff like that that maybe alter our view, that change our perception of who Jesus is, that stop us from withdrawing with him. We forget the truth of who he is and his character. The bear spray in my eyes, both literal and not, is feelings. I often let my feelings dictate how I view Jesus, dictate my perception of him. Now, feelings are good. Don't hear me bashing on that. But there's a guy who said to me once, and he actually just quoted someone else, but he just said, feelings are good guides, but terrible masters. Feelings say something. They point towards something. But when we let them dictate our lives and our views, it's only going to lead to destruction. Again, there's moments, like if you are in a situation where you might die, feelings are important. But I know for myself, when it comes to my relationship with God, there are many seasons in my life where feelings are actually pulling me away, where I'm not actually basing my relationship with Jesus and who he is on truth, this truth, but how I feel. The number one way that I've seen that in my life is judgment. And this is something I still struggle with, and I have my entire life as a follower of Jesus, is feeling like God is judging me, that he's condemning me. God is a judge, just so we're clear, but he's just and he's good and he's merciful and he's gracious. But I have struggled with my whole life, this idea that God is just staring at me going, you'll never be good enough. That there's no way that he could forgive me for the sins that I've committed. And I'm going to be honest. That view of God stops me from wanting to withdraw with him. I feel like if I was to set aside time as one of his disciples, all I would hear is, how could you do that? And I forget what is true, what's in here. My perception of God, my view of him, of Jesus, gets based on feelings, not truth. You want to know what the Bible has to say about that situation? That feeling of judgment? There's a story called The Prodigal Son. It's like my favorite. And I'm sure if you've grown up in the church, you've heard it a million times, but it's just beautiful. There's the son who goes to his father. His father's a wealthy man, and he just says, Father, I want my half of the inheritance. What he just said to his dad is, I want you to be dead. And then the son takes his money, because his father gives it to him. And he goes into town, and he spends it on women and alcohol and gambling and partying, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden, he finds himself just empty, sitting in a pig's pen, looking at their food going, I wish I could have some of that. And then there's this realization in that moment, in the midst of the recognition of his sin, where he goes, well, maybe if I just go back to my father, he'll accept me as a servant, as a slave, that I could just work for him, because that's certainly better than this. And so he's like, I'm going to take my shot. And he gets up and he starts walking, and he's walking up this road towards the house. And before he even gets close to it, it says that his father gets up and runs to him. Welcome home, son. And then he goes a step further and throws a celebration. That's who God is. That's who God is. I need to be reminded of the truth. And I think that in our culture, we really forget that. We really struggle with creating Jesus to be who we want him to be and totally forget about who he is based on this. This is it. This is the foundation. If your vision of God, of Jesus, doesn't align with this, it's not him. It's not, which is a good thing. But sadly, and this is why we have to be careful with this, our views, our perception of him is what's stopping us from being able to withdraw with him. Just like the demons who recognized him and chose not to, and just like the crowds who did not want who he was. Do you want to know how to withdraw with Jesus? The answer that I hope you say is yes. I kind of have three practices or things that you can take away from this morning that would hopefully get you there, and you're going to hear them and you're going to go, well, that's obvious. And it's like, yeah, it is obvious. Maybe it's not to you, and I apologize. I'm not trying to bash on you. First one is this. Say yes to the call to be a disciple. Jesus is wanting to withdraw with those people, the ones who are saying yes to it. The reality is that it might be your first time or it might be your thousandth time saying yes to being a disciple. It's something that you should be doing daily. I know for myself, I find myself needing to be reminded of that multiple times a day. Saying yes, accepting the call, being willing to lay down whatever it is and follow him. That's the first thing. Second one, which might seem shocking to understand how to withdraw with Jesus, is to withdraw with Jesus. Set aside time. Like, people, we gotta prioritize this. We live busy lives, I know that. But we gotta prioritize this. I had someone say one time, you could take a piece of paper and write down a list of all of the things that are super important to you, right? Family, you know, staying active, staying healthy, I don't know, faith, You could write Jesus on that piece of paper. When the reality is, Jesus actually should be the piece of paper that you're writing on. That he's actually the foundation. That getting yourself aligned in truth is more important than all the things on that list. And in doing so, actually makes those things on that list more important as well. It elevates it. Withdraw. That's actually how you do it. You set aside time to be with him. And then the third one, don't build a version of Jesus on your opinions. I do it. We all do it. This is a struggle of being a broken human being. Don't build opinions on your feelings or what you see on social media. Build it on a foundation of the Word. Who God is right in here. This is it. This is it.